Hi, I am Marcelyn Bailey of ML Bailey Consultants Incorporated and Real Social Workers Online Magazine. And I am so excited today. And you can probably see me smiling as I talk because I am just thrilled to have as my guest Dr. Niyama Williams. And Dr. Ni and I met over a year ago when we attended an online class, and we just made a connection. There was something about her that drew me to her, and I'm so glad to have met her, at least over the phone, and I'm know that you'll be excited to hear from her. She has a lot to share with us today. First, I want to share a little bit about her. She has a blog that talks about homelessness, managing depression, and trauma recovery. She's also an author, a prolific author, and her books include The Journey, Steven, which was named for Steven Spielberg, the director, and Opening the Sheila Dennis Reader. Dr. Ni is the host of Journeying with Dr. Ni on Blog Talk USA, which is a member of Blog Talk Radio. I am, again, very excited to have her, and I know you're going to hear some things that are going to encourage you and to that will touch your heart. Hi, Dr. Ni, how are you?
I am thrilled to be here. I have such belief in the work that you do, Marceline, and I am just so excited to be your guest, to talk further with you. Any opportunity to speak with you is a blessing.
Thank you. Niyama, let me ask you this. You are an intuitive counselor, and you're located in California. What part of California?
I am in Long Beach, California. And I just call myself an intuitive because I am not, I don't have a master's in psychology. And so I have to be very careful about using the title intuitive counselor. So I just like to say I'm an intuitive and that I love to assist people in taking the concrete steps to step into the life that they dream of living. And I want them to stop dreaming and actually come up with a list of tasks that they need to accomplish so that they can actually step into living that life and not just dreaming about it.
Tell me how you got into this type of work.
Well, you know, I am in many ways I am relaunching my business. And I say that as someone who has, so to speak, taken her own medicine. And by that I mean I have devoted myself to meditation in the morning and meditation at night before I go to bed, and a regular spiritual practice. And it is my firm belief that if you can meditate, even if it's only 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at night, and then if you have a regular spiritual practice, whatever your faith tradition might be, those two combined will give you the spiritual grit to face any life challenge. And I have seen that in my own life recently. As I wasn't always a confident business owner, I didn't always put myself out there as forcefully as I do now. And so my goal for the relaunch of the business is to work with social workers, case managers, those who assist the folk who are dealing with homelessness, who are dealing with generational poverty, who are dealing with mental illness or addiction or any kind of economic or social ill, okay? I want to reach the workers first and say, look, give yourself 10 minutes in the morning. Give yourself 10 minutes at night. Have a regular spiritual practice, and you'll begin to see changes in how you deal with the workload that you may have, how you deal with the burnout, how you deal with the overwork. And as you see those changes in your own life, you'll be able to model those changes for your clients. And then your clients will begin to have the confidence and the spiritual grit to make the changes they need to make to lift themselves out of generational poverty, to lift themselves out of homelessness or addiction. And so that is my dream, is to really get those workshops up and running, approach agencies, DPSS, DCFS, approach those kinds of organizations so that I can present both to the workers and to the clients. That's my dream at this point, and to have my books available at those kinds of workshops.
And we've talked about the stress that social service providers are under. Social service providers are often understaffed. The agencies are understaffed. They have very little capital to work with. And it seems as if the problems that families face are never ending. And so there is a very high burnout rate. There is a very high people are disillusioned in the work. Mm-hmm. How exactly can you help turn that around, at least the attitude towards the work?
You know, it begins with self-care. Because what I have found for myself, when I take care of myself, when I rest adequately, when I spend that time in the silence, really communicating with myself, with the force I believe is a benevolent force in the world, when I feed myself healthy, whole foods, right? When I take care of myself, it changes my entire perspective and changes my entire attitude. So that my belief, based on my own experience, the workshops I'd be presenting would definitely be based on what lifted me out of homelessness, what helped me cope when surviving child abuse, what helped me cope when surviving neglect. These are things that I have put in practice in my own life. And so what I have to offer is my own story of how simply sitting down twice a day and sitting in the silence, not just taking it as an opportunity to rest, but as an opportunity to speak to that force that I believe is a benevolent force that really is pulling for us in the universe. It is critical to have a belief in something greater than yourself that is benevolent. And so those two things combined really will help you take better care of yourself, will help you come up with ways to deal with that overload, that overwork, that burnout in a way that is productive and doesn't keep you in the same rut, in the same cycle, that doesn't keep you demoralized and depressed.
Mm-hmm. I think that that was beautifully expressed. I'd like for my audience to hear a little bit about the struggles. You touched on having experienced child abuse, but you also, as an adult, went through a series of traumatic experiences that would have it would have caused some people to, in essence, give up. And you have not. Can you share a little bit about that, please?
Absolutely. You know, it's really interesting. Growing up in a challenging home, you learn that you're supposed to take care of everything yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I stress, is having that belief in something greater than yourself that is a benevolent force. And so it was critical for me to get away from Los Angeles, where I grew up, and undertake a doctoral program in Philadelphia. I needed that physical geographic distance from my family. And little did I know that the doctoral program that I undertook was going to be a life and death struggle. Little did I know. There was a huge fight over the chairmanship at the institution that I went to. And they drew students into that fight. And before I knew it, I was, you know, checking into the mental health unit every other weekend, it seemed, to deal with the stress of that battle and being drawn into that battle. And then when I finished the program, my dissertation chair let me know that she was not going to assist me with my first job search, that she was not going to put a letter in my file. So here I am facing an academic job search with no support. Which made it impossible for me to get a first academic position. And that led me into teaching part-time for almost 18 years because it was very difficult to get a full-time position with no support from your dissertation chair.
Right.
That led to my not being able to get a position, having to teach part-time, not making enough, and my first bout of homelessness.
Wow.
So fortunately, I moved in with a friend of mine, and we stayed together for 4 years. We got involved in a romantic relationship. And then as the fourth year rolled around, he said, you know what, I really want to go back to being a minister, and I can't be living with a young, vibrant woman when I'm going to be going back to being a minister. So there I was, all of a sudden homeless again with all of these degrees, right?
Right.
And, you know, homelessness in Philadelphia is very different than homelessness in Long Beach. And I endured about, maybe a year, year and a half in Philadelphia. And I want to emphasize to your audience that homelessness is something that can happen to anyone. And that's why I want to make sure your audience is prepared to know that if you do that meditation, if you have that regular spiritual practice, you can prepare yourself to deal with anything. And what I learned from my journey through homelessness was that it's not all on me, that I'm not the one who has to solve all of my problems alone. There is a force in the universe that is there for you to call on, for me to call on, and it will answer when I call on it. And that was the biggest thing I learned from homelessness. Whenever I would get see myself backed into a corner when I was at a shelter and the women in that transitional housing and the women in that transitional housing were upset because I was getting up, going to the library every day, spending my day working on my blog posts or working on my radio show or working on my books. And, you know, the epitome of their days were meals and TV time. And so in many of those instances, I was targeted because I was getting up being productive. And two things came out of that. Number one, I understood that they had given up hope. And so that kept me from being resentful and angry because I had known what it was like to give up hope. And I said, you know what, I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to keep being loving and kind and accepting because I know where they are, and I want to show them there's another option. Okay? The other thing I learned that was I was becoming very good at functioning as a homeless person, and I was not putting my focus on finding permanent housing. And that's where mindset really plays into what I really want to make sure your listeners understand. It's not enough just to meditate twice a day. It's not enough just to have that regular spiritual practice. Mindset is critical. How you think about your life, how you think, period, what you think matters also. And so how you think about your job, how you think about your situation, how you think about your workload, all of it affects the outcomes that you experience in your life. Mindset is critical. Excuse me. Mindset is absolutely essential.
I'm
and
glad
so
you
really.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go, no, finish, please.
No, I was just going to say mindset is absolutely essential because that determines how you think And what you think about where you are determines what will happen in your life.
And I'm so glad you, brought that up, because part of the work that I do is to help social workers and those in the helping professions see a vision for their work and to develop a mission statement. And basically, they develop or come up with an outcome. And all of their actions, all of their thoughts, all of their behavior targets reaching that outcome. And that's very similar to what you're talking about in terms of mindset. Because in social services, again, there are people who are working in social services who are disillusioned. They feel as if they don't have hope in the work that they do. They don't have hope that anything is going to change. However, as you said, if they put their trust and their faith in their higher power, and if their mindset is targeted towards what I believe is a positive outcome, they will see the benefits and they will be able to do work that will benefit the people who are coming for the assistance. And not only that, as you said, they will model for those individuals a great deal more.
Absolutely.
Niyama, you have you talked about not looking for permanent housing. Tell me how you got from that point to where you are now.
You know, a combination of all three things. The first thing I did was shift my focus. I said, okay, you don't like living in transitional housing. You don't feel you're living with your tribe. You need to focus on where you want to be. What is your goal? And I said, I want an apartment all on my own with a door, with a key, with a lock, and I'm the only one with the key. I said, that's the first priority. Mm-hmm. I said, and along those lines, I began to change my thinking, and I began to visualize. Visualization matters. I began to visualize having this place that was going to be my own place. I already had furniture. I had furniture in storage, and I wanted a place big enough for all of my furniture. So I began to, you know, create this list of what I was looking for. And then I began to look for apartments. And I did not accept anything that was not in alignment with my vision. And I must have looked at 8 to 10 apartments before I decided on the one that I'm in now. I looked and I looked and I kept looking until and when I saw this apartment, I knew it was the one I wanted. And I literally have over 1,000 square feet in a one bedroom.
Wow.
Okay. The minute I saw this apartment, I knew it was the one that I wanted. And it's really interesting how you can change your mindset and how that can change your reality. I said, you know what? I really want a place of my own. I feel ready to have a place of my own again. I'm tired of being in transitional housing with people who are upset about all of my activity. And literally within about a couple of weeks, I was in a shelter. I got out of the transitional housing I was in. I was in a shelter. And if you know anything about shelters, you have to be gone for the bulk of the day.
Right.
And I didn't like that either. I said, you know what? I'm gonna do this until I can get to something better, until I can get to what my goal is. And at a certain point, it was about 2, maybe 3 weeks into the time I was at the shelter, and I got sick. I was throwing up, you know, nauseous, and I said, I think my blood sugar is probably really high. Went to the emergency room. Blood sugar was over 450 because I'm diabetic.
Oh my.
And the doctor said, we can't let you go home with a blood sugar over 450. We're going to have to keep you in the hospital. I said, okay. the physician that was assigned to my case literally came in and talked to me the next morning because I was admitted in the middle of the night. He came in, he said, we understand that you're homeless. We are going to find a nursing facility, a nursing home for you until we can find you permanent housing.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, my goodness. Now, I later found out that he ran a nursing home and that I had, quote, unquote, the right kind of insurance.
That good insurance.
I had the good insurance. You know, I was medi-medi, you know. So he was happy to put me in his nursing home. But the critical thing was I said yes. And mm-hmm. what I mean by saying yes, because I was working with the Homeless Innovations Program, which is a magnificent program under Mental Health America Los Angeles here in Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And the wonderful thing about the Homeless Innovation Program is that they will come to you. You don't have to go to the building because the other half of MHALA is the village. And to get services from the village, you have to actually go to Fifth and Elm. But Homeless Innovation Project will come to you wherever you are. And I had a particular, what did they call him? Not just a peer counselor, but he was basically the social worker that was assigned to me, right?
Okay.
And he knew me well by this time because it had been about a year and a half to 2 years that that I had been under his care. And I was known as someone who would advocate for herself. If the place they sent me to had roaches or mice or whatever the problem was, I was like, I'm not staying here because da-da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. And so I was known for being one who would advocate and who would complain if the if the situation wasn't, you know, right. Okay? But at this time, I said, you know what? This man is offering to house me. I told my social worker, I said, I am going to go there, and be quiet. I said, whatever this nursing home looks like, I'm going to go there. I'm not going to complain. I'm going to stay there. I'm going to be there until we can find for me permanent housing. Mm. And that was a huge shift in my attitude.
Wow.
Because that doctor didn't have to care about me. You know, I was probably the 900th diabetic he'd seen that month. Okay? I just happened to have good insurance. And to show you how powerfully the benevolent force in the universe can move and how quickly it can move, I was literally at that nursing home 2 days, and my social worker came to me and said, Homeless Innovations Project has received 15 Section 8 vouchers. We voted to see which of our clients would get the vouchers, and we voted you as one of the people to receive the voucher.
Wow.
And in about 2 months, I was in my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
That was in March. I looked at apartments and looked at apartments and looked at apartments, and I moved in July 5th of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I say, go ahead.
No, please, finish.
I was just going to say, that's why mindset, and when you need to shift your mindset, when you need to change your mindset, that can really determine what happens in your life, what manifests in your life.
So it's not just that you're waiting or you're hoping, I may not phrase this correctly, basically you bring good things to you because of your beliefs and because of your mindset. Good things come. I like to say you get what you give. So when you're giving, because whatever you give, it's going to come back to you. So if you're giving, if you're positive and you're focused on the positive and what you're putting out is positive, positive has to come back to you.
And one of my concerns is that if you're in a job, if you're a case manager, if you're a social work professional, if you are a nurse who deals with the homeless or the mentally ill or the addicted, you may not feel as though you have anything left to give.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I start with that 10 minutes in the morning and that 10 minutes before bed. Because just that time for yourself, time that you're not giving to someone else, time that demands are not being made of you, time when you can really sit in the quiet, in the silence, and really listen to your spirit, and really understand what's going on with you. You can't change your mindset if you don't know where you are. Okay? You can't change your mindset if you don't know where you are. That's why I start with that 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the evening. And I literally stole that from one of my business coaches.
Really?
The author of Premier Coaching. He said, I won't work with anybody who doesn't meditate. And he started us. He said, just do 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the evening. And who can't, you can find 10 minutes. And I recently told a friend of mine, if you get up in the morning and you go to the bathroom for 10 minutes, that's 10 minutes.
Right. Right.
You know, that's 10 minutes.
Absolutely.
When you're not going to be disturbed, when you can really just sit and focus and listen. So many times it's about listening to your spirit. That's why we get the illnesses that we get. Many times our body, our spirit is trying to communicate something, but maybe trying to give us direction, might be trying to let us know what's really going on with ourselves, but we don't stop to listen. So often that opportunity to really tune within and just listen to what your spirit is trying to tell you, you may be surprised. And it may be the key to getting rid of that stress-induced illness.
Niyama, I would like, I know you have a special treat for us.
Yes.
And in the way of some of your written works. And I'd like to ask if you would like to share that with us right now.
Well, you know, I was thinking very carefully about what I wanted to read for you today, and I decided on the first poem from the collection Stephen because it begins in an unusual place, and yet it ends with a social ill. And I wanted to share this one with you first. And if we have time, I have another one to share with you. But I thought
great.
I'd start with Breastless Women. America is afraid of a full-breasted, heavy-hipped white woman. All the big female stars are flat-chested. Meryl Streep got every role at Yale, but she don't have no tits. Hell, even Halle Berry's skinny as a whale, so she plastered all over Essence. I watched The English Patient, marveled at how natural it was, her dropping her dress to get in the tub with him. Nothing lewd or obscene, just something natural lovers do. But she didn't have no tits either, flat as an ironing board. And I thought, where is the naked white woman with a bust line, with a butt? What happened to that blonde model a few years ago leaned on that car in that black and white dress and changed some minds? Marilyn Monroe stroked white women out. Women were getting breast enlargements, praying for hips, couldn't deal with the big legs. What happened? We went from Marilyn and Rita Hayworth, pinup girls with something to hold on to breastless waifs. Meryl, Sharon Stone, Sandra Bullock, Julia Roberts, Halle. The Waiting to Exhale women had some padding, but Bare Bones Whitney was the star, the only one we saw in the throes of passion. What gives, Hollywood? What gives, America? Men are supposed to be attracted to what looks fertile. Is breastless in? Then why the news magazine story, women going out of the country for implants? Why only full-breasted women for porno? What gives, America? Or is that it? You can't give. You cannot nurture. We've known this since our arrival. The Indians learned too late. You cannot nurture. You ridicule signs of plenty. You do not want the appearance of plenty, of lushness, because then people would ask to eat, to be fed, to be whole. Breastless women, who did not nurture you, America, and why have you cut off her limbs?
Wow.
I warned you. It starts somewhere unusual, but
wow.
It ends with, you know, we would act, you know, if we had those visions of lushness
right.
and plenty, we would expect to be fed.
Right.
We would expect to eat. We would expect plenty.
Right. Wow. Share another, please.
Okay. One moment. Now, this one could probably get me in trouble. Probably get me in trouble, but that's where my spirit says I need to go.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually is why I entitled the collection Stephen. And I'll just read the poem and pray that your listeners do not disconnect from you.
I want to apologize to you, Niyama, and to my listeners. If you hear a phone in the background, I was so excited to talk with you, I literally forgot to move the phone. So.
Well, that's quite all right. I just wanted to make sure you were okay.
No, it's good. I'm good. So for those of you who do not know, this is Real Social Workers Online Magazine.
Okay.
Real, and we're just being real. So,
okay.
But please, you have another poem for us?
Yes, and this one is controversial. I will let you know it is controversial right up front. But something in my spirit says I need to be courageous and just put my foot on out there.
Okay.
So this one is called Schindler's List, and it has two epigraphs, two quotes before the poem. Moment, let me get the
okay.
right audio up. And yes. We are going to go to page 32, and we just might, yep.
All right. Yay!
I tell you, do I want to read Schindler's List? Yeah, I really do want to read that one. That one is just at the, because
mm-hmm.
it's such a controversial piece, and yet it speaks to something that many times is not addressed. Especially in American history.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if we can get through it this time.
Okay.
The premiere of Spielberg's Schindler's List on network television was fittingly a landmark occasion. This first viewing of the film left me not quite the emotional wreck I was after Oprah and Jonathan Demme's Beloved. What stuck, however, was Spielberg's question following the longest credits in film history. When do we begin to hate, he boldly asked his shell-shocked audience. That, he said, was the question research for this film made me want to answer. The answer came to me as easily as if someone had posed a simpler query, such as, what, pray tell, might be the time? And then there's a quote from Donna Richards, The Implications of African American Spirituality. She says, spirit does not die. If we continually make that religious and philosophical statement through ritual, and if we remember, then the physically deceased members of the family continue to be a part of that family, and we are assured of immortality. For the family to be healthy, its continuity and wholeness must be continually experienced. And then the poem begins. We begin to hate, Stephen, when we are deprived. Your people's songs survive, Stephen. Ours have been ripped forever. Our progeny nor our ancestry only so far, then there is nothing, blank space. Your people's family pictures were destroyed. whole branches of our families were split, broken, fractured, seeded forcefully with foreign seed, and wiped from the griot's memory. We cannot mourn our dead because we have no names to give them. They're given names. What does this term mean? In Africa, were they given names, or does the term arise from a slaveholder giving you a name? Your songs survive, Stephen. In even my dimmest memory, I have no idea who my people were. I go back so far, and then dust, tears, bodies at the bottom of the ocean. I could not cry for your people, Stephen. Your people have a place to go back to, living monuments, lists, names, dates, places, firm memories, spaces, and an otherwise complete family tree. For me, for my people, there will always be permanently severed branches, Maafic shears. Nothing grows in barrenness. We cannot fabricate what was deliberately stamped out of existence. I have no home, Stephen. My people have no home. Forever, Stephen. This is a permanent hurt, an irreparable damage. No foundation can connect me to my people ever. The connection is irretrievably lost. Forever, Stephen. So no, I could conjure no tears for the Jewess in furs evicted from her home, her gold menorah taken, stored, cataloged. Her descendants at least will know her name, can go to a mass gravesite and point, can go somewhere in Europe and find kin. My people are forever strangers to me, Stephen. I will die and never know the songs I might have sung, the scars I might have worn with honor, the mutilation I might have suffered. I have no sympathy for the Schindler Jews, Stephen, because they were everywhere singing, and my songs are permanently forgotten. How do you excuse robbing a people of their origins, Stephen? What honest film can you make about that? I have no tears for the Schindler Jews, Stephen, because for all their misery, Stephen, Holocaust survivors maintain their history. They have records, names, dates, history, songs, songs, Stephen, memories. I will forever be a blind woman on the African continent, my people's names stripped even from epic memory, my origins annihilated, Stephen. So I do not mourn for the Schindler Jews, Stephen. Their malady is finite. I do not know how long black people will pay for what we were forced to give America. And somewhere in the place we all wait to be born, my African ancestors starve and wait, Stephen. My ancestors starve and wait.
You know, you have such powerful words. You can feel it. It's quite remarkable. If there's, they are not words, just words. It's the feeling. It's very. It's you can feel it, and it's very picturesque. If that makes sense. Very moving.
People often say that my poems, they can see the pictures.
Yes.
They're listening.
Yes, absolutely.
Visual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Niyama, again, I just want to thank you so, so very much for being my guest today. Also for sharing those two powerful works. They're remarkable and very thought-provoking.
Yes.
So I want to thank you. They were very good choices.
So welcome. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for doing the work that you do. It is critical for the population that you're serving. I applaud you.
Well, I greatly appreciate you. And if you stay on the line, I'm just gonna sign off.
Okay.
I want to thank all of you for listening. And again, we were fortunate to have Dr. Niyama Williams, who is an intuitive in Long Beach, California. Her website is www.drniyamawilliams.com. And I'm Marceline Bailey of ML Bailey Consultants Incorporated and Real Social Workers Online Magazine. And as always, take good care.